This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. NATO is bombing Serbia while Milosevic is driving ethnic Albanians out of Kosovo. What's at stake for Milosevic, NATO, and the people of Kosovo? Earlier today, we called Roger Cohen, who learned the history of the region when he covered the war in Bosnia for the New York Times. He's the author of a book about the war called Hearts Grown Brutal. He's now the New York Times Berlin bureau chief. We called him earlier today in Berlin. Kosovo is a province of Serbia that is trying to secede from Serbia. Critics of the NATO bombing are asking, why should we intercede in a civil war? If one of the American states tried to secede from the Union, what business would it be of any other country? Roger Cohen says the situation in Kosovo isn't really comparable.
Well, first of all, in the United States, we have a democratic system. We have the rule of law. We have freedom of the press. Kosovo was an autonomous part of a country that, for all intents and purposes, no longer exists. That is Yugoslavia. The status of that place was arbitrarily changed in a brutal way by Milosevic 10 years ago. He removed the autonomy. He began to persecute the majority population. That people, because they're in a one-party state, they had no say, no means of talking about that. This state, Yugoslavia, that used to exist, had, as I said, 8 seats on its collective presidency. Milosevic grabbed 4 of them. He grabbed Kosovo because he took away the autonomy. He grabbed Vojvodina because he took away the autonomy. And he installed his own people in Montenegro. So he had 4 of the 8 seats. And then when the other people in Yugoslavia, Croats, Slovenes, Bosnians, started saying, well, hang on a second, this is now Serbislavia. It's not Yugoslavia. We don't think this is still recognizably our country anymore. And we want out. Then Milosevic started saying, well, if you want to leave, I'm going to shoot you. He reminds me of somebody who smashes all the furniture and then gets angry with people for not wanting to sit down with him. He destroyed the architecture of the country. And then he turned around and said, you leave at your peril. Now, if there was a coup in the United States and if Congress was disbanded and had an army general in the White House and I don't know what other events, the mass shootings in Chicago in an arbitrary way and nobody in Chicago allowed to protest or say anything about it. And then some part of the United States said, well, hang on a second. This is not the country we signed up for. This is not, we don't want to live under this system. Of course, it's a different situation, Terry, I think.
Can you talk a little bit more about the importance of Kosovo to Milosevic and why he's willing to risk the devastation of Belgrade in order to keep Kosovo?
Well, the Serbs are a people driven very much by myth and by history. History is not in the past for the Serbs. It's immediate and present. Kosovo, that area, was where the medieval Serbian empire and civilization flowered. It's evident even today in some of the most beautiful monasteries in the world, which are 3 or 4 Serbian monasteries, notably at Dečani and at Peć in the Kosovo area. It's also the site in 1389 of the Battle of Kosovo, which was a losing battle. The Serbs lost that battle to the Ottoman Turks, and that led shortly afterwards to the crumbling of the empire of which I just spoke. But Kosovo, despite the fact that it was a losing battle, has become the symbol of Serbian nationhood, of Serbian heroism. It's said that Prince Lazar, who led the Serbs into battle that day, lost an earthly kingdom but gained the kingdom of heaven. And one of the interesting things about the Serbs, I think, is the way that in defeat, often they tend to see victory, and in destruction, the kind of destruction that is going on now, they find some kind of vindication. As I covered the Bosnian War, I often thought, talking to them, that victory and defeat were largely inseparable in their minds. So I think Kosovo is this extremely potent symbol. Side by side with that, there is the modern reality, which is that Kosovo is 90% inhabited by Albanians. And those Albanians, every single one of them at this point, I think, no longer want to live under the rule of Belgrade.
And, you know, the Kosovo Liberation Army is trying to get Kosovo to secede. from Serbia, and Milosevic is, of course, trying to stop that. Besides all the historical import of Kosovo, what's at stake for Milosevic now in trying to hold on to Kosovo?
Well, I think he feels that his hold on power is intimately linked to holding on to Kosovo. It was in Kosovo 10 years ago, 12 years ago, that Milosevic first launched his nationalist message, telling the Serb minority there that they would always be defended. And in 1989, on the 600th anniversary of the Battle of Kosovo, assembling 1 million Serbs at the site of that battle and saying that battles may yet be to come, as indeed they proved to be. It's very hard, Terry, to gauge how Milosevic's support is cemented. That's to say, what degree of control he has over the army. He got rid of the commander-in-chief just a couple of months back. He got rid of the head of the secret police as well, and Mr. Stanisic. There have been tensions within the regime. It's still very much, for all its veneer of democracy, a one-party state, and it's extremely impenetrable. However, I think Milosevic clearly judges that he could not tell the armed forces, could not tell the Serbian people that NATO would come in and police a peace agreement in Kosovo as NATO wanted. I think at that point he judged that the army would feel that Kosovo had been lost. So he has attached a deep importance to it. What we have to find out now is whether there are disaffected elements in the army, in the police, who see what destruction, extraordinary, unbelievable destruction, this man has wrought not only on the people surrounding him, the Muslims of Bosnia, Croats, others, but also on his own people. It's not clear at what point the people around him in the army and elsewhere, seeing this daily bombardment, will begin to react. I'm not entirely convinced by these stories of the bombardment bringing unity. Of course, at one level, the Serbs are banding together now because they feel under attack, and many feel unjustly under attack, perhaps. But I'm convinced that there are tensions there beneath the surface.
My guest is Roger Cohn. He covered the war in Bosnia for the New York Times and is the author of the book Hearts Grown Brutal, Sagas of Sarajevo. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Roger Cohn is my guest, and he covered the war in Bosnia for the New York Times. He's now the Times Berlin bureau chief. He's joining us by phone from Berlin. The leader now of the effort to secede from Serbia is the Kosovo Liberation Army. What is the Kosovo Liberation Army, and how does it compare with the previous leadership of Kosovo?
Well, when I was going to Kosovo in the mid-90s, the spokesman for the Albanians was always Ibrahim Rugova, who is in hiding at the moment, if he's alive, who lives in Pristina. And he, has always been, he had a sort of Gandhi-esque approach and felt that in Kosovo for a long time, the Albanians, ethnic Albanians and Serbs, have been living parallel existences, really not intermingling in any way. In that way, it's very different from Bosnia. The Albanians have their own schooling, their own quite separate housing. They really, since their autonomy was quashed, they've chosen to have nothing to do with it. Now, Rugova basically was a moderate and believed that with time, by force of the overwhelming number of Albanians there, say 90% of the population, the fact that most did not want to stay in Serbia, that a political movement could prevail. However, after Bosnia, after seeing what Milosevic did to the Muslims of Bosnia, and most of the Albanians are nominally Muslims, even if very few of them are particularly religious, a movement did begin to grow up in the last couple of years that believed Rugova was wrong in his moderation, and that only through force of arms would the Albanians secure the independence that they seek. The KLA is quite splintered. Its exact leadership has long been fairly murky. That's been one difficulty in dealing with them. They're financed mainly from the expatriate Albanian communities in Switzerland, in Germany, and in the United States, and they're obviously gaining support from Albania itself, although Albania is not a country with many resources. And they have been providing weapons and money to this movement. I think it's worth noting that there's been one Serb obsession in this myth-driven rampage that many of the Serbs have been on the past decade, and that's the infiltration of Islam into Europe. I remember being told on countless occasions by sub-generals and others that Islam was trying to penetrate Europe, and the means was what they called the Green Transversal. Now, the Green Transversal, I think, was largely a figment of their imaginations, but what it was a green line, green being the color of Islam to them, going up from Istanbul through the Muslim Albanian population of Kosovo through into Bosnia. And even in the early 90s, the Serb generals were talking about quashing, ruthlessly quashing, this so-called Islamic attempt to take over Europe. In fact, most of the Muslims of Bosnia, before they were persecuted, were very, very secular people whose main preoccupations were getting to the beach in the summer and having a good beer and living their lives. And the Albanians, too, had very little, I think, Muslim. The mosques in Kosovo, whenever I visited them, were empty. I suspect that in Kosovo, as in Bosnia, we may get a reaction whereby the Albanian population will come to identify more with their religion at this point.
The Kosovo Liberation Army, which is leading the effort to secede from Serbia, they don't really have a great record of supporting ethnic diversity either.
No, they don't. And, you know, we are, Terry, dealing with a part of the world where peaceful intermingling and coexistence, it's existed. It's existed to some extent under the Ottoman Empire, to some extent under the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and certainly in Bosnia under Tito for about 50 years. And indeed, historically, there has been, I mean, on the one hand, the kind of Arcadian myth of Bosnia as this place of idyllic intermingling was wrong. On the other, it was also completely wrong to say it was a place of ancient tribal rivalries. I mean, the truth lay somewhere in between. There was a lot of intermarriage and so on. I think, you know, when you're oppressed, frankly, you don't think about ideals of intermingling. You think about your freedom and your safety, whereas we understand freedom to mean democracy and certain rights and the rule of law and so on. I think when you live in a place that's under an oppressive system and people start talking of freedom, freedom means escape. Freedom means, you know, like in the Soviet Union, for several of the countries there that have gone their own way since the end of communism and Yugoslavia itself, freedom means escape. And right now, freedom for the Albanians means escape, escape from rule of Milosevic, escape from Serbia, escape into independence. And frankly, I doubt they're giving 5 minutes thought to intermingling. I think it's a rather dismal conclusion, but in a way, you know, I believed in Yugoslavia, and I still believe that Bosnia exists in some people's hearts and minds. But, you know, I think the process of ethnic disentanglement and segregation in the Balkans has now gone so far that perhaps the best medium-term hope for the area is that this separation be completed. That's to say that Kosovo gain its independence, that Montenegro gain its independence, that we finally have a nation state that's called Serbia, and we don't have this stupid, meaningless name of Yugoslavia being bandied around. The only Yugoslavia that was worth anything went up in smoke several years ago. And then, on the basis of these nation states, like elsewhere in Europe since the war, World War II, we get a gradual process of integration where the borders between these nation states become essentially meaningless. I mean, you drive now from France to Germany, you don't even know you've crossed the border. 50 years ago, that would have been absolutely inconceivable. And taking a medium-term view, maybe if we can somehow, you know, end the fighting and complete this dismal, awful process that's gone on under Milosevic for 10 years now, then a generation from now, that process might begin to take hold.
Now, you're the New York Times Berlin bureau chief, so you've been writing about the story from the vantage point of being stationed in Berlin. Now, Germany is part of NATO and is participating in the airstrikes against Serbia. What's the significance of that in Germany?
Well, I think for the Germans, it's, you know, for a long time after the war, the mantra of Germany was that only peace would go out from German soil. The effect of the Third Reich, of Nazism, and of the catastrophic defeat was for the Germans to say that never again would they in any way participate in any form of war or aggression. What I think we see today is Germany's, a now unified Germany, no longer at the front line of the Cold War, no longer constrained by those Cold War imperatives. A Germany, in a sense, ruled by people who were not alive at the time of the Nazis, whose parents were Nazis, but who they themselves were not alive. A Germany that is sort of coming of age, that doesn't want to be any longer an economic giant and a political pygmy. A Germany that feels very strongly about human rights and about the rule of law and about democracy, about the things on the basis of which it's rebuilt itself. And that Germany has decided to participate despite the difficulty and the historical echoes of because Hitler, of course, bombarded Belgrade in a very savage way. I think it's a Germany that's coming of age and is ready to assume its political responsibilities. It's been controversial, but the big majority of Germans backs it. And the fact that it's a left-leaning government, social democrats and environmentalist greens, that's to say the people at the head of the peace movement in the 1980s, who've taken this decision, the government of Chancellor Schroeder, I think that in a sense has made it easier, because had they been in opposition, they might have been vocal in saying this was not a good idea.
Has Milosevic been using the participation of Germany in the airstrikes as an example of how this is Hitlerian?
Well, I think there have been references. They said the first day they'd shot down a German plane. I don't think the choice of a German plane was a coincidence. The obsession with German aggression. You know, the Serb mind is very much locked in the past because they have no future at the moment. The economic implosion under Milosevic has been total. So, and the past is World War One, which began with Austro-Hungarian and then German attack, and World War Two, of course, when Hitler came in. So I think they are trying to use that for whatever propaganda value they can get out of the fact that there is this small German participation in the force. In Bosnia, all this barracks used to be adorned with posters showing the blue flag of the European Union, the blue and gold star flag of the European Union, with swastikas appearing all over it, and there was the slogan under it was, "Are you ready for Deutschmocracy?" And that was everywhere in Bosnia, in the Serbian barracks. I think it shows the depth of feeling of the Serbs and their inability to recognize that Germany has changed.
My guest is Roger Cohen. He covered the war in Bosnia for the New York Times and is the author of the book Hearts Grown Brutal, Sagas of Sarajevo. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Roger Cohen is my guest. He's the New York Times Berlin bureau chief, and he covered the war in Bosnia. We're talking about Serbia and Kosovo. Milosevic, I guess you could say, is from a troubled background. His father, his mother, and his uncle all committed suicide. And I don't mean to just do a little psychiatric thing here, but I'm wondering if you know of, like, psychohistorians who are trying to analyze the psychological explanations for his tyranny. And if anyone is saying...
It's been a suicide and redemption, loss and victory, damnation and salvation. They're all... It's all very linked, I think, somehow in the Serb psyche. This notion that through suffering you achieve some kind of vindication. What strikes me about Milosevic is he's an extremely apart from this moment in '89 when he was riding this wave to power. He's essentially an apparatchik. That's to say, he operates in secret, in a closed way. He's a closed personality. He never appears before his people. He very rarely appears on television. He attaches no value that I can perceive to human life. When 200,000 Serbs, his own people, poured out of Croatia in 1995, in the mass and brutal eviction of Serbs from Croatia that took place at the end of the war there, when the Croats fought back and destroyed the autonomous areas that the Serbs had carved out in 1991, when those 200,000 Serbs bedraggled on tractors, walking, struggled into Serbia proper, after 7 days of trekking across Bosnia, Milosevic did not address a word to them. He did not appear on television. He did not greet them in any way. I mean, they were furious with Milosevic because he'd armed and goaded them to fight and then abandoned them. But that, I think, is Milosevic. He is a man for whom everything is an abstraction. He never, when the questions have been put to him about the concentration camps in Bosnia, he waves his hand in the most nonchalant, dismissive way, as if to say, what nonsense, never existed. Well, maybe for him in his mind, they never did exist. I mean, he never went there. He never saw them. And one of the interesting things about what's going on now is that throughout the wars of Yugoslavia's destruction, destruction has gone out from Belgrade to Croatia, to Bosnia, to Slovenia. You name it, it's gone there. But it's never hit the heartland of Serbia before. So I think there is a kind of psychological shock for Milosevic and for other Serbs, and I think it's unpredictable how that will play out. But the suicides, I think, well, they would have to mark anyone, and they certainly, I think, marked him very deeply and perhaps contributed to this extraordinarily coldness and closed nature of the man.
I'm wondering if you've been getting any emails or phone calls from contacts of yours in Bosnia from the period when you were covering the war there, and what their reactions have been to watching Serbia bombed.
Well, I have been in touch with Haris Zecevic, one of the Bosnians whose family was destroyed and whom I portray in my book. And he, you know, they feel at last is basically their sentiment, I think. That at last, you know, the man who destroyed their lives, I mean, Haris's mother and brother were both killed. You know, I think it's very easy to waver. I mean, nobody likes bombing. Nobody likes to see, and I'm sure there are civilians being killed by this bombing, even if a limited number. It's hard to remember sometimes with the immediacy of the images, but you talk to Haris and you do remember that there are so many thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people's lives whose blood, directly or indirectly, is on this man Milosevic's hands, that I think it's worth remembering that. Their basic feeling is, you know, I hope that America will stay the course, and they are relieved that, to them, there is some form of justice, some form of balance in things. I often heard in Bosnia that there will be a day of retribution. Maybe we're coming close to that day.
Have you been in touch with any Serbs in Serbia about their reaction
to
the bombing?
I've spoken to friends in Belgrade, people I know in Belgrade from the time I spent there, and these are people, I'd say, on the more, I mean, certainly not great supporters of Milosevic on the liberal spectrum, but they are, well, number one, I think they are frightened and shocked. There is this sense, I think, of the war coming home. I mean, Belgrade was from the place from which war went out. Now war is coming to Belgrade. I remember Koljevic, Karadzic's deputy in Bosnia, being so shocked when NATO bombed near his house and complaining to an American official who said, "Welcome to war, Mr. Vice President." I think these people have, you know, 6 years after, 7, 8 years after the wars began of Yugoslavia's destruction, it's come to Serbia. I think people are shocked. They're indignant. These people were feeling very, very lost. They're older people. They were not going down into the bomb shelters, preferring to stay in their homes, but very worried about, obviously, their children and grandchildren. And it was difficult for me to talk across this gulf I really felt now dividing us, because my own view is that this is really the right policy, that Milosevic, that this destruction cannot go on indefinitely in Europe. And of course they see it from their perspective of bombs coming out of the sky, a sovereign state that has an insurrectionary movement was trying to deal with it, and you know, how is it different from Northern Ireland, or if somebody wanted to secede in New Mexico or something? You do feel that certain things, you know, whatever contact existed before, that it's hard to explain across that gulf.
So the people who you're talking about may oppose Milosevic, but they also oppose the bombing.
That's right. They do oppose the bombing. They feel it's outrageous, and they feel frightened. And they feel that it will regroup support around Milosevic, which it may in some ways in the short term, but I think at some point, as I said earlier, I suspect that some serious political divisions might emerge.
Well, Roger Cohen, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Roger Cohen covered the war in Bosnia for the New York Times and is the author of Hearts Grown Brutal, Sagas of Sarajevo. He's now the Times Berlin bureau chief.